I assume, I'm not sure about this, but I assume that most of you remember something about the Old Testament. It's part of the Bible. I also assume that if you know anything about the Old Testament, you remember there was a book in the Old Testament called 1 Kings. Maybe if you remember anything about 1 Kings, you also remember there was a man named Elijah. You may also recall that this man named Elijah hid out in a cave from God. He hid from his responsibility. Now also, if you know anything about the Bible, you know anything about me, I always have to rewrite the Bible. So tonight, if you'll permit me, I'd like to paraphrase 1 Kings 19:9-21. Now I would advise you not to try to follow in the Old Testament. The Lord's forgiven me for this, and I hope you will. I've changed the man's name to Alan instead of Elijah. Alan ran back to his dormitory room and gave up for the last time. But the Lord came and said to him, "Why are you hiding here?" And he answered, "Lord, I've always tried to do what you wanted me to do. But the church refuses to minister to all people. It continues to build bigger buildings and neglect persons. It dismisses its clergy if they attempt to speak prophetically. Lord, they refuse to follow you, and now they won't listen to my suggestions." God said, "Leave this place and look around you." And the Lord showed Alan his world, a bursting shell on a Vietnamese hill, the hunger and thirst of a Biafran child, and after that, a Berkeley riot. After the riot, a fire in the ghetto of Washington, D.C. But Alan didn't understand what God was trying to tell him. And after the fire, God spoke gently to Alan. When the Lord spoke, Alan pulled his sweater over his head and hid once again in his room. And the Lord said, "Alan, what are you doing here?" And he answered, "Lord, I told you. I've always tried to do what you wanted me to do. But the church refuses to minister to all people. It continues to build bigger buildings and neglect persons. It dismisses its clergy if they attempt to speak prophetically. Lord, they refuse to follow you, and, well, now they won't listen to my suggestions either." And the Lord said, "Alan, you have no business hiding here. You have work to do. You're not alone, nor have I forsaken the church. Go back into the world." I have a feeling for most of us during this week, we've been hiding in a cave. Many of us have been hiding in different kinds of caves. Tragically, some of us have been hiding in the same cave of the same name, but on different sides of the mountain. We've been condemning one another, expressing our disgust for what one has said or another, or agreeing with one, or not agreeing with one. In the meantime, the world is hungry. The world is without clothing. The world is without ministry. The world is without love. The world is without the Christ that we debate from day to day. Perhaps you've read the poem, "I was hungry and you formed a humanities club and discussed my hunger. Thank you. I was imprisoned and you crept off quietly to your chapel in the cellar and prayed for my release. I was naked and in your mind you debated the morality of my appearance. I was sick and you knelt and thanked God for your health. I was homeless and you preached to me of the spiritual shelter of the love of God. I was lonely and you left me alone to pray for me. You seem so holy, so close to God. But I'm still very hungry and lonely and cold." I suppose one of the things that we who come to these conferences do is to listen to you and to other people. I've been listening this week to the caves you've been hiding in and I've been hiding in. And I suppose the one cave that's been discussed the most is one called evangelism. And I thought at first it was one cave, but I found there are two of them, one on either side of the mountain. And some have been hiding in a cave, and they've been condemning social action. saying that we have to do it exactly this way if man is to come to Christ. We've quoted four spiritual laws, or three steps to get there. We've talked about the fact that if a man mentions anything else, he couldn't possibly be a Christian. But then there's a cave on the other side of the mountain, and I've been to that cave and visited also. For those people hate the techniques of Campus Crusade or Baptist Student Union or anything that would attempt to proclaim that Christ is Lord. That group is offended by the Elmer Gantry types, and I would have to say I probably agree with them. But while we hide in the cave and discuss what is right and what is wrong, man has never come to know the person Jesus Christ. I was on a college campus last year, a Baptist college campus. I was there for a couple of days in one of these discussion groups that goes late into the night in a boys' dormitory. The fine Christian leadership of the campus had been there, the preacher boys. They had told me how they disliked the hippies on campus, the flower power, the hair power, and all of those odd groups. Finally, when the discussion ended, a young man who was not of the religious group of the campus came in late, sat down, waited till everybody left, and then he came to talk to me. He said, "I'm not a Christian, and I'm not sure I ever will be, but I really wanted to come and talk." "It's an interesting thing," he said to me. "This is the fourth year on the campus. 2 weeks every year, I'm sure that they're going to be concerned about me and love me. That's the fall revival and the spring revival." He said, "During that week, you can't imagine how many people come to my room to visit me. They come in, they smile, they carry their Bible, they sit down on the bed. 'How are you? You know, how was the football game? By the way, are you saved?'" And he said, "Then they began to tell me how concerned they are about me." And he said, "Then I wait until late in the spring when the spring revival comes, and I know they'll come back again. 2 weeks out of every year, they love me." And he said, "The rest of the year, they don't give a damn about me." He said, "Why should I care about their God?" I think most of us sit around discussing whether or not this technique is right or not, or whether I should attempt to do this. And most of the time, the very simple Christian witness that could be given by our life and our word is neglected. I think also we're discussing the fact in some groups that it needs to be done the old-fashioned way. Others are saying new and creative techniques ought to be done, and yet nobody really does anything. I visited a campus in Texas this year where some students had decided something was to be done. They decided that instead of just talking about sharing the Christian faith and attempting to have dialogue with the non-Christian community, they would do it. They decided, first of all, we've got to move out of the Baptist Student Center over on campus. They got one of the lecture halls on the campus. They advertised not as Baptist Student Union or revival meeting or anything else, but Dialogue 69. Their discussions for Dialogue 69 were crisis in identity. Interestingly enough, the people who came each night, most of them were the non-Christian people on campus, or at least the non-religious. About one-fourth, perhaps, would have been the Christian community. During the day, they had coffees where people came and talked. One morning, I sat talking to one atheist and three agnostics, or at least this is what they said. But they'd come to talk. The night sessions, there was a lecture in this arena, followed by a move to one of the parlors in the Union Building on campus. The last night, there had been discussion over in the arena, and something was said about a leap of faith. The fact that man finally has to come to a time when he either tries to believe or he decides, "I give up." We moved then to the parlor for the discussion. We'd come down to where I finally said, "We have time for one more question." And one young man and his fiancée, who had been there every night, held up his hand. It was the first time he'd spoken. He said, "Tonight you said something about a leap of faith. If you've tried three times before to leap and there wasn't anything there, is it worth another try?" Dialogue 69 will probably never appear in any kind of evangelism handbook, but it is possible that these students, in their creative way, had attempted to break out of the normal mold of evangelism to share their God and who they were with the non-Christian community. But there's another cave we've been hiding in this week also, besides evangelism. That's a cave called the church. And I really think there might have been almost as much discussion about this cave as evangelism. And I found out there were two of these caves also, one on either side of the mountain. There's the one group here who would say there is nothing wrong with the church, now shut up and like it is. Sing the hymns even though you don't understand them. Worship. Shut up and pray. Any man who wants to believe can come to our church and enjoy it just like we do, or he doesn't need to belong. And then there are those on the other side that says everything is wrong with the church. There's no hope. I think there are some, even if the church were to change, they wouldn't like it. I spoke at a BSU convention last year, and the theme of the convention had something to do with the church. I spoke and later was on one of the campuses in the state visiting, and this student came up and he said, I'm one of the intellectuals on campus. And I had nothing to say to him. He said, how come they ask you to speak at things like BSU conventions? And I said, well, I don't really know. He said, I think I know. It's because you're so slick. And I didn't know what he meant by that. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, you always quote from the right books and you've always read the latest thing and you know about the latest movies. You know, I didn't really know that myself. And he said, but you know what I didn't like about you? And I said, no, why? He said, you really weren't relevant this year. And I said, why? He said, well, you didn't condemn the church enough. And I'd gotten criticism from other students because I'd condemned it too much. I think there are many things wrong within the church. I think it's obvious to us. And I don't think we're ever going to do anything about it unless we determine that you and I are going to work together to change the church. But again, while we spend our time arguing about the relevancy of the church, man goes without a ministry. Man goes without a witness. And I really think also that sometimes we wouldn't want the church to change, and we wouldn't accept it if it did. For instance, I have a letter here from a Jewish man in Birmingham, Alabama, to the Birmingham News. The letter reads, I would like for you to be aware that the Baptist Women's Missionary Union is sponsoring a community service activity whereby educated adults from the various churches within the union pledge themselves and prepare themselves to teach illiterates to read and write. These educated adults are sincere and dedicated to the principles of their church and are providing a service that is almost unbelievably humane. I say almost unbelievably because in my experience, I have rarely seen any supposed religious person pledge himself to the betterment of his fellow without any other benefit than to the heart. The First Baptist Church of Birmingham has established classes for those who work for me who are intelligent but illiterate. I cannot describe to you the very pleasant feeling I have that although I am not a Baptist, these instructors are my brothers. I cannot contain my admiration. And so, in the small measure of this letter, I want to publicly thank them for being true Christians. I think we could look at this, and we look at perhaps Second Baptist Church in Lubbock, Texas, and the clinic which they sponsor for underprivileged people. And we look and we say, yes, but look at the rest of the churches. And we have to honestly admit there is something wrong. But do we spend our time only admitting that something's wrong, or do we creatively try to get out of the mess we're in? This week, you've had all sorts of creative workshops. And you go back home to your church and you tell people about it, and if they won't have a coffee house, you give up. And you go back to hide in a new cave back in your hometown. I think there's another cave this week that I've heard people talking about they were hiding in. It's called integrity. There are those who say because of their integrity, they must protect the Bible. They must defend the faith. The Bible is the sole authority. You must be saved, redeemed, eternal life. These are words which mean something to them. And then on the other side are those who discuss the I-Thou relationship, the leap of faith, the ground of our being, Bultmann, Buber, Kierkegaard, and others. Could it really be that both of us are playing theological Scrabble? Could it be that both of us are theological vultures, sitting looking at one another and not seeking truth in our God? Truth won't negate my God. We as Baptists proclaim more, I suppose, than anybody else, the priesthood of the believer, and practice it less. We talk more about the infallibility of God and believe it less. I want to stop long enough to say something to those who serve in student work as directors. I wonder about the Cave of Integrity this week. I wonder if we want Charles Rozelle and the new student department to succeed. I wonder if you as students really believe that your denomination could provide something for you that could work in this world. What about your integrity? Are you really willing to let God work within us and through us to accomplish something? During the years I worked in the student department, there arose a situation where some of us had difficulty with an individual. I would come back to my supervisor, Dr. Doyle Baird, every Monday morning and say, I've prayed it through. I can get along with the individual. But the first time I saw the individual, I had hate, disgust, dislike for the individual. Dr. Baird said to me one day, what would you do if that person changed to be like you wanted them to be? I didn't have any problem because I didn't believe they would. He asked me that question many times, and then finally, after about a year, he said, what if you prayed to God to change that individual, and the individual were changed? Would you accept him? And I went home that night and I prayed. And when my answer to that question was no, I knew that much of the problem was with me. I really wonder what could happen in Southern Baptist student life if students and student workers alike believed that the same great God who has brought us to this place could take us far beyond to minister and witness in a world. There's another cave. And I've heard a lot of you discussing this one this week. It's called race relations. And some of you just turned your hearing aid battery off when I mentioned the word, because I've heard you as you walked out night after night what you've said. Here we go again. There are those who would say, we just don't understand, give us time. There are those on the other who say, act now, do something, talk, dialogue. Last year during the conference, a young man came to Nell McGee one night, about the first night of the conference. Very concerned young man, and he said, I would like for students to get together from various campuses throughout the country and talk about what we can do on our campuses in the area of race relations. Now, he said, I'm not talking about writing up things. I'm talking about action that we can take on the campus. And so Nell arranged a room for him and any other students who wanted to meet. A few nights later, a group of students came to talk to Nell and to me and to Nathan Porter and some others. And they came with some resolutions. It wasn't the young man who had asked for the conference. They had three resolutions on race relations. All of those things required that the student department do something. But you could leave here and not do a thing. When it was thrown back in their face, they did revise it, and some of you helped. And one of the revisions was that you would go back to your campus and you would seek during this year to minister like you've never ministered before to the black student. You also said that we will go back and we will attempt to enlist the black student in Baptist Student Union like we have never done before. Interestingly enough, last year we had the most black students at Glorietta we've ever had. It's possible that this year we have the fewest. It's also interesting that last year when those students who wrote up the resolution worked together, not a black student was invited to come meet with them. On the last morning, as I was headed to the car to leave to drive to the airport, three students, black students from California, came up and said, who was that young man that was in charge of all those resolutions? We think it's interesting that he never spoke to any of us during the week. He doesn't know who we are or what our needs are, but he can write resolutions. Now, in all honesty, probably you felt you'd done something worthwhile, and you had. And some of you in the service on Tuesday night last year came forward and you gave of clothing and goods that you had that somebody would be helped. Piled them up in a room and walked out and asked that Mark Short distribute them to some people. One young man named James Herod from Kingsville, Texas, worked on the resolution, helped collect the clothing, And he got back home to the campus and to his hometown, and something bothered him. He felt like he would burst if he didn't do something there. He talked to another student named Glenn Barbier, and they decided, we can't just work at race relations with resolutions. And they moved into a house in the black slum of the city. They began to fix up the house, to work with the neighbors, to minister in any way they could. On Easter Sunday morning, they had a worship service at sunrise in their backyard with the group. And then they picked up the lawnmower and the hoe and the rake and the sickle. And they walked next door to the old Negro lady's home and said, part of our worship today is to be of help to you. At the end of the year, in bidding goodbye, she said to them, I love you so much. I wish you were black. Year after year, we come to Glorietta. And year after year, we make all sorts of promises on paper, with voice, but our belief has not been expressed till we find some way to go back home and minister and witness to persons. Another one of those caves this week has been depersonalization. Some of you have talked about how even some of your directors could care less about you. Week before last in New York City, a butcher in one of those ghetto neighborhoods realized that a crippled lady who came to the shop every day hadn't been there in 5 days. He looked up her address and he went to the apartment and he knocked on the door and got no sound and he went in. He found her dead. And in her hand was her diary. For 3 days had been written the words, no one came today. And you and I get upset about the ghetto in the inner city. And we go back to the college and the university campus, and there are hundreds and thousands of students there who could write in their diary every day, no one came today. I really wonder if we're willing to come out of the caves to not only talk about belief and commitment, but to give ourselves completely, to become sensitive to people, to needs, to learn to care about people, to share our faith, to minister to all people, to express our love. I still believe in Jesus Christ. And I still believe that in this day and time there are persons who need Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord. I still believe that there are people in this world who need a ministry of Christian love that comes because you have known the person, Jesus Christ. But you're going to have to come out of the cave. I can't force you. Camus, the contemporary existentialist, says, I don't understand you Christians. I don't share your hope, but if you have it, why don't you proclaim it? I want to read to you a letter that came to Britton Wood just last week. Britton Wood is the BSU director at North Texas State. It's from a young man in Vietnam. Now, I know what just happened to some of you when I mentioned Vietnam. You begin to debate the morality of the war in Vietnam. I don't like the war either. But would you listen? For I think the young man who wrote the letter would want you to hear what he said. Dear Britton, how are you and the BSU doing? I suppose you are both fine, or at least I hope so. I guess you are preparing for Glorietta. Well, I've been here about 2 weeks. Tomorrow, I step out and see what life is. The last 2 weeks, I've almost gotten out of shape. I've been processing and going through school. Actually, I haven't done much of anything. Today was a typical day. I went out to eat lunch. Afterwards, I went swimming. Later this evening, I played football. I figured I'd better get in shape today if I was going to. It's hard to tell you how I feel today. I know that tomorrow I'm stepping out into a different world. I guess it's the uncertain, unknowing feeling that really bothers me. I know I probably won't be doing anything for a few days, but Absolutely anything can happen anytime. I have made up my mind to do what I can for my men and me to get back alive and in one piece. Well, I guess I had better sign off for now. I have faith that your prayers are with us. Say hello, and he lists five students, three of whom were non-Christians on his campus. And he closes the letter. The next morning, on his first patrol, he was killed. His funeral was Sunday in Benton, Texas. I really believe if the young man were here tonight, he would like to say to you, it's hard to tell you how I feel today. I know that tomorrow I'm stepping out into a different world. I guess it's the uncertain, unknowing feeling that really bothers me. I have made up my mind to do what I can for my men and me. Tomorrow you're not stepping out into death. And I read this not to get you to cry. I read this to make you consider that a life has been given you for a purpose. A life has been given me for a purpose. And we don't know what tomorrow brings. But the same great God who has given you life will also give you victory. But you have to come out of the cave. You have to go out where people are and minister and witness. We're going to stand in a few moments and sing 418, Once to Every Man and Nation. Comes the moment to decide. There may be some here tonight who have never come to know the person Jesus Christ. And you would come and say, could somebody talk to me? I would like to meet this person. Perhaps there's someone here tonight who would say that I must become involved in the political arena of my college or university campus. Perhaps there's someone here tonight who would have to say, I have done an awful lot of talking. I have been the intellectual. I have never put my life on the line for God or man. And tonight, to the best of my ability, you would come and say, here is my life. Perhaps you know something that you've got to do, some call that God has given to you, and you would like to express it tonight.